Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Yada Yahweh Radio. Today is Wednesday. It is May 4th, 2011. I thank you for joining us. Today is going to be a special edition, as have been the last 2 days. Whether or not we conclude our discussion on bin Laden and his death, as well as the bigger picture, which is the influence and ongoing nature of Islamic terrorism or not, I cannot say for sure today, although my desire would be to return to a far more important topic tomorrow, which is the introduction to God and our continued presentation of His Word, His name, His Torah, His covenant, His commandments, as well as His called out assemblies. Before we begin our topic of the day, I would like to just remind you that in the news yesterday, what I consider to be the most important, although sinister, news item in probably a decade. And I don't think that this news item even made the fifth or sixth pages of any newspaper. I don't think it made it onto most any newscast, because we were fixated as a nation on a has-been in the case of bin Laden. But the big news was that brokered and, well, let me just read the some excerpts from this article, and then I'll comment on them. It reads, dateline is Cairo, Egypt. The two largest Palestinian factions, the West Bank-based Fatah, which is the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, is founded by Yasser Arafat, who at one time, by the way, was the world's most noteworthy terrorist, Islamic terrorist, and the Islamist group Hamas, which rules Gaza, formally adopted a reconciliation agreement Wednesday in Cairo, Egypt, state TV showed. Now, why would it be in Egypt? Well, the reason it was brokered in Egypt is because the voice of Egypt now, control of Egypt now, is the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is the founder of both the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, which is Fatah now, and also Hamas. They founded both organizations, and the Muslim Brotherhood founded both organizations in Egypt. And the moment that Mubarak was deposed, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood returned to Egypt, and in his opening speech before 3 million people, they all chanted death to Israel, and that they announced that their primary goal will be to reject the peace accords that were formed with Israel and to make Israel part of Egypt, to wipe it off the map as it currently exists. That is their stated goal. And so to accomplish that goal, they took two of their terrorist organizations, Fatah, which is the PLO, and Hamas, and said, okay, guys, one of the reasons that we're not able to accomplish our goals is you guys are fighting each other rather than fighting Israel. So we're going to play nice. We're going to pretend to play nice. We're going to act like we're unified. And therefore, we will be able to deploy Muhammad's strategy, Hudabayah. Hudabayah is the strategy where Muhammad came with too few men under arms to conquer Mecca, and unable to conquer it, he signed a peace treaty with the Meccans, saying that I will, for the next 10 years, I will stop terrorizing you, I will stop robbing you, I will stop killing you, I will stop kidnapping your citizens, I will stop enslaving your citizens. For 10 years, I promise that I will stop doing all of these horrible things I've been doing to you. And the following year, he came down with 10,000 men under arms and promptly conquered the place, but not before he had his God say in the ninth surah, any treaty between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim. The concept of Hudabayah. When Yasser Arafat was negotiating on behalf of the PLO to control parts of the West Bank and Gaza, when he signed an agreement, he said, I did so in the spirit of Hudabayah. And every Muslim in the world applauded him, knew that knowing that he was using deception. And the West, we just yawned, because 99.999% of Westerners are ignorant. when it comes to Islam. And therefore, they do not understand the role that we played to make Israel more vulnerable. Yah himself speaks of this through his prophet Yeshayahu in the 17th and 18th chapters of that book, where he speaks of a land where he uses 13 adjectives to describe America and says that this land is guilty of looting Israel, of thinning my land at the waist, which is precisely what giving the Muslims Gaza and the West Bank for their nation is all about. And the moment that happens, it will be like Neville Chamberlain giving the high ground of Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. 6 months later, the world was embroiled in a war. It was not his to give. It was the wrong thing to do. It was morally bankrupt. And yet that is what the United States and the West is now committed to doing. Crowds, of course, this article says, cheered outside of the building where the deal was inked. Egyptian officials told CNN the agreement was signed by the parties Tuesday. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon welcomed the deal and sent a top representative to the ceremony. The entire purpose of this is to create the illusion of unity amongst the terrorist factions so that Israel can be forced into giving up the high ground of Judea and Samaria to Muslims. And when they do, because the United States has already forced Israel to surrender Gaza to Hamas, when they do, Israel will be 10 miles wide at its waist, where 70% of its population reside, and ultimately indefensible, and the Muslims know it. Anytime you can be opposed to something that Jimmy Carter is for, you have very good odds of being on the high moral ground. Jimmy Carter is a raging anti-Semite. This article says former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who I despise, he is the man, by the way, responsible for the uplifting, the armament, the funding of Al-Qaeda. Without Jimmy Carter, Al-Qaeda as an organization would have long since ceased to exist. Jimmy Carter, working with his national security advisor and CFR representative Zbigniew Brzezinski, and with Robert Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, funded Al-Qaeda to the tune of $5 billion, equipping them so that they could first lure the Soviets into Afghanistan and then bloody their nose. And they, of course, don't hide from this fact. They take great credit and pride in what they have done. And yet, it is what has led to this war that we are now engaged in. We went from Vietnam, where we were equipping the Soviets so that they could equip the Vietnamese to kill our soldiers knowingly, to creating this new enemy and equipping them and giving them the weapons that they are now deploying. Just as we are arming Muslims in Afghanistan and Iraq with weapons that they will one day deploy against Israel. Anyway, Jimmy Carter, who helped broker the historic peace treaty between Israel and Egypt 3 decades ago, hailed the Fatah-Hamas deal as, quote, a major step forward that could ultimately bring what I've wanted for the past 30 years, which is peace in Israel. He does not want peace in Israel. He wants a piece of Israel. Always has. There is no peace in Islam. Never has been, never will be. Islam is a war manifesto against all mankind. That's how it was conceived in the Pledge of Aqaba. Day one of the Islamic era begins with a pledge where Muhammad's followers, the first Muslims, said, "We pledge to wage war against all mankind on behalf of Muhammad." They want a piece of Israel, and the peace they want is 100% of it. And they will stop at nothing until they have their peace. Netanyahu, which means Yah's gift, told Netan is gift in Hebrew. Yahu is the abbreviated form of Yahweh. told Blair, how can peace be achieved with a government in which half of the ministers call for the destruction of the state of Israel and praise the master killer Osama bin Laden, as of course Hamas did day before yesterday? What we're witnessing here is the prelude to World War III. World War III gets as much ink and scriptural prophecy as does any other event, the Magog War. The Magog Federation, which is headquartered in a unified Iran-Iraq, courtesy of the United States, and includes nations like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkey, Muslims for the Caucasian region that would never have been free to engage in the Great Jihad had it not been for the role of Zygmunt Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter and Robert Gates and the funding and armament of Al-Qaeda to bring down the Soviet Union and free these Muslims to engage in this war. It will, of course, include Egypt, which is now under the auspices of Iranian influence, as is Iran, another gift courtesy of the United States. All this is being done because Hamas, of course, now is controlled by Iran as well through Hezbollah, because Iran is now the power of the Middle East as a direct result of America's invasion of Iraq. We have set the stage, we have lit the fuse for this war, which will be fought beginning in 2027. The fuse has been lit. All we now need to do is just watch as it burns and all of the things that come together along the way, including all of these revolts that are happening across the Islamic world, where fundamentalist Muslims are rising up against their secular dictators, and where, as we find in Egypt, some 70 to 75% of them are in favor of the imposition of Sharia law, which is the most repressive form of governance probably ever known to man, based entirely on the Islamic hadith, which are featured in the book Prophet of Doom, which those who are listening can go to prophetofdoom.net and read it for free. It is all the prelude to the Magog War. But we'll talk about that more later. Today, I want to return to the story of the killing of Osama bin Laden. It is interesting, of course, that America's administration, the Obama administration, is changing its story regarding the assassination of bin Laden and the obvious reality that Pakistan was complicit in harboring him. Seems like a new story comes out every hour or so. They, of course, say that, okay, well, the mistakes that we made 2 days ago when we said that bin Laden was armed and engaged in a firefight, that he used a woman as a shield, that we went in there with the intent to capture him and hold him for bring him back for trial. Okay, so that wasn't really true. The inference that we gave that the Pakistan government was supportive of this mission, well, that wasn't really true. He was unarmed. We had absolutely no desire whatsoever to bring him back for trial, to learn what we could learn from him. Just wanted to kill him. Dead men tell no tales. The whole thing reeks, as they then took this man and gave him a Islamic burial, cleaned up his body and wrapped it in white linens and buried it within 24 hours. All repulsive. The bottom line here is, do not trust your government. When your government is talking, they're lying to you. But they get by with it because most Americans have lost interest in the truth, preferring to believe a myriad of myths, both religious and political. And they've lost the ability to process information rationally, morally, and judgmentally. Yes, the preponderance of Americans fall into that category. Let me give you the best or worst examples of this. Americans believe that the Crusades to dispose Saddam Hussein and to kill bin Laden were just, moral, beneficial, worthwhile, even noble. And yet, in the case of Saddam Hussein, both arguments used to invade Iraq were lies. There was no purchase of yellowcake uranium. There was no viable nuclear program underway there. In fact, there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, the president, who constantly said that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and bin Laden, between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and that's the reason we needed to go fight the enemy there so we didn't have to fight them here, was a complete and utter lie. We engaged in the war in Iraq based on lies. Lies which the president knew were lies at the time that he used them as the justification with the American people, knowing that the American people wouldn't give a damn. And they don't. They reelected him, knowing that he lied. And, of course, this trade. We traded some portion of the 7,000 American dead and 70,000 mutilated and $2 trillion to take out the only secular dictator in the Middle East and replace that government with one that is controlled entirely by Iran, removing Iran's only enemy in the region and giving the country and its oil riches to the Iranians, forever shifting the balance of power in that region and causing what is our real enemy to be hugely empowered as a result. In other words, we made a very bad situation much worse. That's not moral. That's not noble. That's not rational. That's not beneficial. That's stupid. And of course, with bin Laden, yeah, fine that he's dead. I have got no issue with him being killed. Bad, evil man. But when you realize what the cost was to kill him, two unwinnable wars, genuinely a third one in Pakistan, and now a fourth one in Libya, but these two initial unwinnable wars, all for revenge, to get our justice with this man, and we traded the lives of 7,000 additional Americans, 70,000 mutilated bodies to kill him 10 years later. It's not a good trade. It's not a moral trade. There were so many other ways to tear that man's heart out and to torture him, which would have been used the occasion of 9/11 to expose and condemn Islam, to read to the nation the hadith that Osama bin Laden followed, to read to the nation the Quran set into the context of Muhammad's life and expose that evil, immoral book to the nation so that it would have destroyed the credibility of bin Laden's motivation. It would have been a far more painful punishment and far less costly and infinitely more moral. Since there is this overall concept, and it was throughout the papers in the news today that America killed the founder of al-Qaeda, dedicated much of the program yesterday to demonstrating that's not the case. The government is again lying to you when it says that bin Laden was the founder of al-Qaeda, that he was the founder of a new ideology, and that he was a charismatic leader. None of those things. He was not charismatic. He was very soft-spoken. And the ideology of al-Qaeda is fundamentalist Islam. He did not invent it. He was not even the founder of al-Qaeda. Muhammad Abdullah Azam was. Today, however, al-Qaeda's philosophy remains identical to that crafted by Dr. Muhammad Abdullah Azam. for the most part, the organization, apart from now bin Laden, he went in a different direction for reasons we discussed yesterday, but the vast preponderance of what is known as Al-Qaeda today seek to overthrow un-Islamic regimes in the lands once ruled by Islam and replace them with fundamentalist Islamic theocracies. Israel is such a place, and the United States is seen as aiding and abetting the Jewish enemy. But all of these uprisings, the ones in Yemen, in Syria, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Libya, in Tunisia, yesterday we saw it in Indonesia. There were riots, of course, in the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in particular, and in Saudi Arabia. Because fundamentalist Muslims were rising up trying to overthrow secular dictators. And they played a huge role in it. Now, bin Laden was the only guy who was still clinging to his past grudge, the grudge that occurred when he went to the Sauds and said, let us throw out Saddam Hussein from Kuwait and repel him from entering Saudi Arabia because he is our enemy. Saddam Hussein was the enemy of Al-Qaeda. The United States was not Osama bin Laden's enemy. We were his benefactor. We supplied him with all of his money, with all of his weapons. His enemy was Saddam Hussein. But, of course, George Bush the first, King George the first, because of his ongoing relationship with the Sauds, financial relationship, said, no, let us do it. And the Sauds chose America. And that affront to the Mujahideen who had just deposed the Soviets in Afghanistan was more than the egotistical Osama bin Laden could handle. And he changed his enemy from Saddam Hussein to America. 9/11 is the result. And so even in his last years, where he was no longer the head of Al-Qaeda, we have absolute proof that for the last 5 or 6 years that he has not been the leader of Al-Qaeda. His only role was as a spokesperson, writing letters to the various affiliates around the world, telling them that, you know, their fixation with overthrowing non-Islamic governments can't overshadow their need to kill Americans and destroy America. Still fixated and living upon that crutch. Al-Qaeda, however, despite what the president says when he says that we're at war with Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda really is no longer a terrorist organization. Now, that'll sound as a surprise to most, but it's more of an association of other terrorist organizations. It's a loose confederation of like-minded Islamic groups. They exist in the spiritual rather than the material realm, which is why the West neither understands them nor combats them effectively. While their carnage is certainly physical, the assets they deploy are mostly religious. Al-Qaeda will ally with Islamic terrorist groups anywhere in the world to further their goals. These include Islamic clubs fighting Muslim governments with allegedly apostate rulers. In other words, rulers who are more secular than they are Muslim, at least from the point of view of the jihadist, such as Egypt, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Yemen, Nigeria, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, well, at least Iraq pre-invasion. Now it's controlled by the Shia mullah in Tehran. Jordan and Syria. They ally with Salafi organizations fighting regimes perceived to oppress their Muslim citizens, such as in Kosovo, India, Kashmir, Russia, and the Philippines. They support Islamic terrorists fighting to establish their own Islamic state, such as in quote-unquote Palestine, Chechnya, Dagestan, Mindanao. Originally, Al-Qaeda aided terrorist organizations by by training group members in its camps, both mentally and spiritually. The foundation means, the base means, to send them back with a strong spiritual base in Islam, and by sending its members out to help other Islamic groups succeed in their missions. But that really is no longer the case, and hasn't been for a long time. Now they are mostly a trade organization, offering various resources to member groups. If you were to eliminate every vestige of what remains of Al-Qaeda today, it would make absolutely no difference to the perpetration of Islamic terrorism, because Islamic terrorism is based first in fundamentalist Islam, which infects 70% of 1.5 billion people on our planet, but also because it's nothing really more than a trade organization. It's the operational nature of Islamic terrorism now is in hundreds of groups like the Taliban, like the five or six really noteworthy Islamic terrorist groups in Pakistan, like the ones that that perpetrated the bombings in India here not too long ago, like Hamas, like Hezbollah, like Fatah, Abu Shayaf, countless of them. I've got a list of them at the homepage of Prophet of Doom, if you would like to read through them. Also surprising to most, the overwhelming majority of the Al-Qaeda trainees during the years that they actually ran these camps were militia fighters, not terrorists. Very big difference between a militia fighter and a terrorist. A mujahideen and a terrorist. The mujahideen, the militia fighters, were trained to operate in civilian militias with Islamic clerical command and control structure. Nearly 7,000 Americans were murdered by Islamic guerrilla tactics, not terrorist tactics, guerrilla tactics in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the nation should be more cognizant of this truth than it is. The same kind of paramilitary units are ravaging Kashmir. It is estimated that as few as 5% of Al-Qaeda's original trainees were terrorists, meaning that 95% are militia militants preparing to execute guerrilla tactics. It's these militants, these militia. It's the legacy of what Al-Qaeda and the Sudanese government did in Sudan when they murdered 3 million people. It's how they operate in Somalia. I mean, we got our nose bloodied in Somalia. We ought to know this. There's an enormous difference between guerrilla tactics, which is primarily what Al-Qaeda facilitated in its camps, and terrorist tactics. What we're witnessing in Libya are guerrilla tactics, not terrorist tactics. But we're so confused because we've destroyed the meaning of words. We now think that a terrorist is an ideology, when it's nothing but a tactic. Guerrilla is a tactic, and what we're mostly witnessing is guerrilla tactics around the world. You know, Americans have been confused by lies so many times that they have been led to believe that the enemy is terrorism and not Islam. That was the primary purpose of Obama's speech to the nation the night of it was recognized that they had killed Osama bin Laden. His whole countenance changed when he became protective of Islam. He became condescending and angry because he sees himself as the protector of Islam. And as he said, that Osama bin Laden was not a Muslim leader, but instead a killer of Muslims. He was doing everything he could to disassociate Al-Qaeda from Islam, when in fact there is no distinction. That this war on terror is a designed specifically to disassociate terror from Islam. And yet 99% of the terrorist attacks perpetrated in the world today are perpetrated by good Muslims. who confessed to the crime, as was the case with 9/11. Disinformation. Confusing people with the opposite of that which is true is how governments indoctrinate their people. It is what causes Americans to rally behind the flag, to be patriotic, to celebrate something that they should have cried over. Celebrating the killing of bin Laden, not recognizing that it cost America 7,000 lives and 70,000 mutilated bodies, should have been a cause for crying. That we seem to have no ability as a nation to morally equate cost to our execution of justice. Because we haven't a clue who the enemy is. We do not know that we made absolutely no difference in the ongoing influence of Islamic terrorism by taking out an old man about to die of kidney failure. Al-Qaeda members know who they are, good Muslims. They know who their leader is, Allah. They know whose example they are following, Muhammad. These guys are veterans. Most of Al-Qaeda's members have served in Mujahideen and terrorist campaigns in Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kashmir, Mindanao, Chechnya, Lebanon, Israel, the Sudan, Somalia, Algeria, and Egypt. Al-Qaeda's most famous Muslim, of course, as we know, is Sheikh bin Laden. He was born Osama bin Laden in 1957. Made him 54 years old when he was killed. He was born to Mohammed bin Laden, originally of Yemen. The elder bin Laden was a womanizer, having married 22 times. Osama was the 17th of 55 children of this religious zealot and money-grubbing pervert. The OBL mother was Mohammed bin Laden's 10th wife, Alia Ghanem. She was Syrian. Therefore, Osama's genes were Yemen and Syrian, but that is not what made him bad. It was his Saudi upbringing that made him rotten. Osama bin Laden was just 10 years old when his father died, but his influence on his son was immense. At the time of his father's death, the man who would become the world's most infamous terrorist, replacing Yasser Arafat of the PLO and Fatah, was being indoctrinated in fundamental Salafi Islam in schools and mosques under the control of the Saud royal family, schools and mosques built by his father. The beast who would murder thousands of Americans was manufactured by the religion of Islam in religious and academic facilities supported by the Saud warlords in their private fiefdom, known as Saudi Arabia, built by the bin Laden company and funded entirely by OPEC. The West paid the tab for the feudal factories that made the terrorists, which have and will continue to kill them. That's why I've said for so many years that there are three things that the world has to do, and I wrote this in the fall of 2001. The three things that the West has to do if it's going to be effective against fighting and winning the war against Islamic terrorism, none of which America is ever going to be willing to do, but the West would have to do these three things. One, it'd have to regain the high moral ground. To do that, people would have to stop believing the religious and political myths that have indoctrinated them. They'd have to walk away from religion and politics. High moral ground can be found in neither place. And they would have to come to know Yah, as Yahweh revealed himself in his Torah, Prophet, and Psalms. That is the only moral perspective that exists in the universe. Second, they would have to be willing to openly expose and condemn the religion of Islam. To use the Islamic scriptures themselves, the oral reports from Muhammad's companions about the life and words and deeds of this repulsive individual known as Muhammad, who was a rapist, who was a pedophile, who was incestuous, who was a slave trader, who was a kidnapper, who was a mass murderer, amongst the most evil men who ever lived. To expose what the Islamic sources themselves say about him and what his God said on his behalf in his Quran. Demonstrating conclusively, as the evidence does, that Muhammad's God was Satan and that Muhammad was demon-possessed and that he was a ruthless terrorist who cared for nothing other than sex, power, and money. Had we done that, it would have been impossible for Muslims to recruit in the West, where people are given the opportunity of choice and access to information. And in the lands polluted and controlled by Islam, where there is no freedom of expression, there is no freedom of religion, there is no freedom of choice, those Muslims would be hugely hampered from perpetrating their brand of terrorism abroad, because the third thing that we would then do, what we had to do, is to remove the fuel that funds their terrorism. You see, Islamic terrorism had largely dissipated to nothingness with the demise of the Ottoman Empire in World War I. It did not raise its ugly head again until the formation of OPEC, when Western oil capacity was seized, was confiscated, was stolen by the fiefdoms, these personal estates that we refer to as nations, like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Libya. And as a result of them stealing it, they formed a cartel. And rather than the West reacting appropriately and saying, no, you can't do that, that the consequences will be grievous if you do that, the West supported it because it empowered and enriched many. And as a direct result, Islamic terrorism became fueled by OPEC, and now it is a fire that is blazed out of control. All the while, the West continues to pay the bill. And because we have no alternative energy program, and because we never stopped the OPECers from forming this monopoly, today, we fund our own demise to the tune of $3 billion, I should say, a day. Each day, we contribute another $3 billion to our own demise. If you wonder why America has no policy in terms of becoming energy independent, why this president ran on that campaign and then did nothing, in fact, he was counterproductive, that's the reason why. Ultimately, this president doesn't care about the United States, nor did the last one. The destruction of the United States and the enrichment of their allies is the beat to which they march. And that is what we're witnessing before our eyes, all the while most Americans cheer, ignorant of what's going on around them. It all began for at least the man that we killed a few days ago, not long after he was born, in 1964, born in 57. In 64, Prince Faisal, Saad bin Abdul Aziz, deposed his half-brother, King Saud, and began rebuilding the fiefdom, which had squandered its OPEC fortune in meaningless personal indulgences and excesses. From what we can tell, King Abdul Aziz, known to the West as King Faisal, was pleased with the construction work Mohammed bin Laden was doing on his $1.1 billion royal palace enlargement project. And so, as a reward, the Saud king and warlord and dictator issued a royal decree awarding all future construction projects in Saudi Arabia to bin Laden's construction company. And the OPEC monopoly created a construction monopoly, all working in harmony with a destruction monopoly known as Islamic terrorism. Mohammed bin Laden would make his initial fortune from having the exclusive rights to all mosques, all religious buildings, and all Islamic schools in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, where his firm continues to destroy the Temple Mount even to this day. any project funded by Saudi Arabia, which is most of the mosques built around the world, the construction project goes to the bin Laden family. And this means that Mohammed bin Laden built the facilities that corrupted his son, Osama, into becoming the world's best-known Islamic terrorist. It also means that the West paid the bill by way of OPEC. Worse, it means that when five American presidents partnered with his family, they aided and abetted terrorism. During his life, Mohammed bin Laden became a sheikh and one of King Abdul Aziz's closest associates. All the while, Mohammed bin Laden was a devout fundamentalist Muslim, and he demanded that his children observe his strict Wahhabist religious code. So in death, he left an enduring and yet foreboding legacy. In the September 3, 1967 entry into the Islamic terrorist timeline, I detailed the financial history of the bin Laden family and how it influenced the fortunes of American presidents, especially George W. Bush and his dad. Abrusco Oil was funded by bin Laden money. I'm not going to repeat that conversation here, but should you wish to look it up, it is there for you to read. We know that Osama was raised a devout Sunni Muslim, as were and are all Saudi children. He and his fellow Sauds are Salaf fundamentalists, known in the West as Wahhabis, the purest form of Islam, fundamentalist Muslims, not radicals, not extremists, fundamentalists. They are indoctrinated in their schools, in their mosques, and in their political assemblies, and in their media. There is no voice of moderation in Saudi Arabia. From 1968 to 1976, Osama bin Laden attended class in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. His school was funded by Saudi King Faisal bin Abdul Aziz and built by his father. It was there that he learned what he knows about Islam. In Saudi Arabia, the Ministry of Education publishes textbooks for mandatory Islamic studies. Parts read as if they were excerpts from bin Laden's fatwas, and that is because they are all singing from the same hymnal. The Quran is a declaration of war on all mankind, and Muhammad, who was Allah's lone messenger, was a terrorist. We should not be surprised that 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were educated by the Sauds. Approved 8th grade texts teach that Jews are apes, while the swine are Christians. That's not directly out of the Quran, although the Quran does say that Jews are the sons of apes, of monkeys, and of pigs. You have to interpret the Quran's 5th surah as this transformation of enemies. The infidels, who were routinely the Jews, because they were the easiest target for Muhammad to rape and to rob and to enslave, that he overhunted them. And after a while, he needed a new enemy, and so the Byzantine Empire and therefore the Christians became his new enemy. So in the 5th surah, the concept of those who are infidels, those who are against Allah, changed in the 5th and final surah revealed from Jews to Christians. And so what they're doing is extrapolating, because the 5th surah now identifies all of the hateful things which were once associated with the Jews to Christians because they are the new enemy, that the swine are Christians. That's a bit of an extrapolation. Allah is so anti-Semitic. He says that he turned the asses of Jews into their faces. Oh, it's a lovely book, the Quran. More anti-Semitic than Mein Kampf. They say this because the Quran reveals similar material. A 12th grader in Saudi Arabia learns that according to Muhammad and Allah, quote, this is right out of their 12th grade textbooks, jihad, holy war, is a violent struggle against Jews, Christians, and moderate Muslims who do not follow Allah's instructions and Muhammad's example, end quote. The highest-ranking Islamic cleric in Saudi Arabia and the Saud warlord's favorite imam, al-Barak, said this on Saudi state-controlled television, quote, I am against America, She is the root of all evils and wickedness on earth. Muslim, do not take Jews and Christians as allies. Muslim brothers, do not have any mercy or compassion on them, their blood, their money, or their flesh. Their women are yours to take legitimately. Allah made them yours in his Quran. End quote for the moment. I'm going to make a comment and then return to the highest-ranking Saudi Arabian imam's quotation. The Quran, most people don't know, actually condones rape. It says sex with slaves that you've captured in war is lawful and good. It's rape. Involuntary sex. Muhammad was a rapist. Multiple times, the hadith demonstrate, where he himself chose the prettiest woman after his militants had killed their woman's father, husband, enslaved her children. Muhammad would rape her. So the Quran actually says everything he just said, that, you know, that their wealth is lawful for you to steal, their women are lawful for you to take, their bodies are lawful for you to kill. Enslave them. Do whatever you want to with them. Allah gave them to you. That's the truth of the Quran. Anyway, this quote goes on to say, why don't you enslave their women? Why don't you wage jihad? Why don't you pillage them? Speaking of America, this was the example Muhammad established for Muslims to follow. End quote. It is why Muslims do these things. It is why Osama bin Laden was taught in his Saudi classroom. It is why he killed. It is why he plundered. Therefore, he had not corrupted Islam. Islam corrupted him. When bin Laden's father died, he left his young son $80 million, money that came directly from the Saudi OPEC crude. 11 years later, one of the most uncivil men who ever lived graduated from King Abdul Aziz University in Jeddah, with a degree in civil engineering. Every step of the way, the world's most famous terrorist was educated in the Saudi state-controlled mosques and schools. At 17, Osama married the first of five wives. One, author Kola Bouf, claims that she was kept in Morocco as a sex slave against her will, all in accordance with Islam. Since that time, bin Laden has fathered 24 children. Two of his sons, Omar and Abdullah bin Laden, organized the U.S. branch of the World Congress on Muslim Youth in Falls Church, Virginia, during the 1990s. If you were wondering why Osama's sons were allowed to establish an Islamic center just outside Washington, or why they were allowed to leave after 9/11, 2001, the answer is George Bush. He authorized their departure, arranged for their planes to fly when no other planes were allowed to fly on that day. And he prevented the FBI from investigating Omar and Abdullah bin Laden and their World Congress of Muslim Youth. The reason, because it would have been embarrassing to the Sauds and to George Walker Bush. And he cares more about them than he cares about Americans. They are partners after all. The BBC and British Guardian reported in November 2001, quote, high-placed intelligence sources in Washington told us this week, quote, there are always constraints on investigating the Saudis, and the restrictions became worse after the Bush administration took over this year. We were told to back off when it came to investigating bin Laden's family and their ties to the Saudi royals. We were also told not to investigate links, which suggest that the Saudis have acquired Pakistani nuclear weapons, end quote. And they have. The Bush administration did everything in its power to protect the Sauds, which made America more and more vulnerable every day. The behavior would be manifest twice more the following year when the Rand Corporation published their report for the Pentagon examining the connection between the Saudis and Islamic terrorism. The Bush administration had the documents suppressed, its conclusions repudiated, and the team responsible for it fired. Shortly thereafter, the 19-page segment of the 9/11 Commission report detailing what the Saudis had done relative to the attack of 9/11. It was blacked out and classified. This administration, the Bush administration, had something to hide. The truth is, the Bushes are in bed with the Saudis, including even the bin Ladens. The introduction to the London Guardian story, dateline November 7th, 2001, reads, FBI and military intelligence officials in Washington say that they were prevented for political reasons for carrying out full investigations into the members of bin Laden's family in the U.S. before the terrorist attacks of September 11. U.S. intelligence agencies have come under criticism for their wholesale failure to predict the catastrophe at the World Trade Center. But some are complaining that their hands were tied. FBI documents shown on BBC Newsnight and obtained by The Guardian show that they had earlier sought to investigate two of bin Laden's relatives in Washington and a Muslim organization, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, WAMI, with which they were linked. The FBI file marked secret encoded 199, which means a case involving national security, records that Abdullah bin Laden, who lived in Washington, had an open file on him because of his relationship with the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, a suspected terrorist organization. Yes, America, your president, is more interested in protecting the Saudis than he is you. At least he was. I wrote this between 6 and 7 years ago, when George Bush was still in the White House, reporting that it is absolutely a known fact that President George Bush worked harder to protect the Sauds and to disguise the fact that they were up to their eyeballs in 9/11, funding that program, educating the terrorists with their own sons here, and that he allowed their sons and children and family to leave the United States when no other planes could fly. And every time that the intelligence community in America affirmed the direct ties between Saudi Arabia and Islamic terrorism, the Bush administration classified the information and blacked it out. So why would that be? Of Osama bin Laden between 6 and 7 years ago, I wrote that the soft-spoken bin Laden now suffers from kidney disease. He currently lives in Pakistan, probably in Peshawar, where he and Dr. Azam established al-Qaeda with the support of the Carter administration, the American CIA, the Pakistani government through their ISI, and the OPEC warlords corrupting Saudi Arabia. I looked on a map this morning because I read through my old writings and wanted to find out how close was I when I predicted that he was probably living in Peshawar. Do you know that Peshawar is about 75 miles due west of the town where they found him, Abbottabad? About 75 miles due west. Along the road, it's not much further than Islamabad. And Abbottabad is essentially a suburb of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. It wasn't hard to figure out. And yet it would take America another 7 years. The return to Pakistan means that Osama bin Laden and company are all but one breath away from their ultimate prize, a nuclear arsenal, I wrote 7 years ago. Moving al-Qaeda's leadership out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, the only Islamic country with nuclear weapons, which was true at the time, it's not anymore. Now, Saudi Arabia has them, will prove to be the most foolish thing America has ever done. I wrote that 7 years ago. It remains true. I have predicted that America would have such a difficult time hunting down Osama bin Laden that if they were to eventually find him living somewhere around Peshawar, Pakistan, they would likely stumble upon a decrepit old man napping in his pajamas and dying of kidney failure, and that in the end it would make no difference. Al-Qaeda survived the death of its founder, Dr. Azam, and it will survive the death of its previously deposed voice, because the leader of Al-Qaeda isn't either of these men, but instead Allah, the demented spirit known only through the words and deeds of his lone messenger, Mohammed. I have predicted that Al-Qaeda will obtain nuclear weapons and that they will deploy them, but not in Israel, in America. They will sail them into America's largest cities and destroy the nation as we know it. Thus far, I've predicted many things regarding the war on terror that have come true. Matter of fact, the way that the raid with the helicopters and the video camera being played live in the Situation Room of the White House, and the way that raid went down, the number of people in it, read the opening chapters of Tea with Terrorists, written in the fall of 2001. It describes an extraordinarily similar scene going after the head of this terrorist organization. And so many things I've been able to predict, not because I'm a prophet, because I am not, only because I've taken the time to become informed. When Osama bin Laden returned to Afghanistan, he rekindled his relationship, as we know, with Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, a Muslim Brotherhood member, the founder of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and a leader in al-Jihad and in al-Gama al-Islamiyya, the Islamic group. They would ultimately merge their Muslim militant clubs into one organization. Since al-Qaeda today is no less al-Zawahiri's, in fact, today it is al-Zawahiri's, let's examine his credentials. He was born to a middle-class Egyptian family between 1951 and 1953, making him 4 to 6 years older than the man that America just assassinated. He is a physician, he's an author, and he's a poet. At 14, Ayman joined the Muslim Brotherhood. 2 years later, at 16, he joined al-Jihad. Ayman al-Zawahiri was a follower of Sayyid Qutb, the father of modern jihadism. Sayyid Qutb received a master's in scholarship, paid for by American taxpayers, to the University of Northern Colorado. He returned the generosity of the American people by telling Muslims that they must hate and kill Americans. Upon his return to Egypt, Qutb, who was al-Zawahiri's mentor, just as Azam was bin Laden's mentor, was made responsible for public education. In other words, Egypt had entrusted the minds, hearts, and souls of its children to the most influential voice in the history of the Muslim Brotherhood. Sayyid Qutb wrote two books. One was called Signposts Along the Way, and the other one was In the Shade of the Quran. They are essentially the same as Prophet of Doom. You know, Prophet of Doom takes the Islamic hadith as they exist in the four most credible and oldest sources, the Sirah, the Tariq, which is the history, the biography, the history, and the two topical collections by Muslim and Bukhari, and uses them to reorder the Quran chronologically and set the Quran into the context of Muhammad's life so that it can be understood. Qutb, in his Signposts Along the Way and his Shade of the Quran, essentially did the same thing. The only difference is that, judgmentally, I condemn pedophilia, rape, the slave trade, kidnapping, terrorism, mass murder, and lying. And Qutb, being a good Muslim, knowing that these are the things that Muhammad deployed in his creation of Islam, sees them as being good. The only difference. Perspective. Moral judgment. Anyway, these two books, they serve to inform Muslims that jihad is an obligatory duty in Islam. Qutb, more than any other modern Muslim, insisted that all Muslims were the enemy of their religion. All non-Muslims, I should say, were the enemy of their religion. All peaceful Muslims were the enemy of Allah. But don't think for a moment that Qutb was a shallow, one-dimensional, jihad-only type. He was first and foremost a Quran scholar. just like his disciples, the blind professor, Sheikh Ar-Rahman, who was the first World Trade Center bombing instigator, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the second World Trade Center bombing mastermind. These guys aren't, you know, like these dimwits out there that are have corrupted their religion and who are extremists, out of touch with the teachings of the Quran and Hadith. No, they are students of the Quran. They know what it says. They are students of the Hadith. They know what it says. They're living it. They're following Muhammad's example. They're following Muhammad's orders. They are extraordinarily well-informed Muslims, suitably indoctrinated. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is now the head of Al-Qaeda, as the trade organization exists today, moved to Afghanistan in the 1980s to join the Mujahideen and fight the Great Jihad. There he joined Dr. Abdallah Azam and Osama bin Laden, who were engaged with their house of supporters known as the MAK. Al-Zawahiri blossomed under the religious tutelage of Dr. Azam, and he became a first-rate jihadist. Eventually, Ayman al-Zawahiri, a new head of Al-Qaeda, came to hate the somewhat secular Egyptian government so much he founded the Egyptian Islamic Jihad to wage war against his own country. And as we now know, he merged this organization into Al-Qaeda, setting a pattern others would follow. During their tenure together, OBL provided OPEC funding and logistic support, while Zawahiri supplied the Quranic ideology and operational leadership. Now, after the Great Jihad was won, al-Zawahiri returned to Egypt, where he became the most outspoken of Muslim militants. In the late 1996, al-Zawahiri was arrested in Russia for recruiting a jihadist in Chechnya. Rather than deal with him, the Russians took Ayman to Azerbaijani, to that border, and they released him. The French and the Americans didn't have a monopoly on stupidity in this regard. Ayman has been indicted for conspiracy to kill United States nationals, to murder and destroy buildings and property in the United States, to destroy national defense utilities, and largely in connection with the 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. In 1999, he was sentenced to death in absentia in Egypt. The United States State Department has a $5 million reward for information leading to his arrest. By the way, he has been in charge of Al-Qaeda for probably the last 5 or 6 years. It's a complete myth that has now become public based upon released documents that Osama bin Laden was the leader of Al-Qaeda. He was not the founder, and he was not even the operational leader anymore. Shortly after their reunion in 1998, Ayman and Osama issued their joint fatwa under the title of the World Islamic Front Against Jews and Crusaders. Crusaders is Christians. It elevated both men to prominence in the Muslim world. They also created their United Jihad Council, which serves to coordinate terrorist attacks and allocate resources where they're needed. In a sense, Al-Qaeda became a trade organization. The biggest problem with Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden wasn't their terrorist assaults on American and Jews. It is that they and their club, their trade organization, have been made out to be the enemy when they are really just a symptom. When David Long, a State Department official and quote-unquote terrorist expert, said, quote, "If you were to kill Osama tomorrow, the Al-Qaeda organization would disappear," end quote, he displayed the kind of ignorance that enables the bloody hand of Islam. OBL and AZ are simply good Muslims, and there are millions more like them. Killing one or both will make little difference. And capturing Saddam Hussein made no difference. If you will recall, terrorism in Iraq escalated exponentially after Saddam Hussein was killed, after we deposed him. There were an average of 2 terrorist attacks in Iraq each year, both fairly minor. In the previous 7 years of the Saddam Hussein governance in Iraq. And they escalated to upwards in the range of 300 or 400 significant terrorist acts a day after America deposed him. Rather than diminishing Islamic terrorism in Iraq with the American invasion, we escalated it exponentially. Now, I'm not here to tell you that killing Osama bin Laden is going to escalate Islamic terrorism exponentially, because he's a has-been. He's not been the head of the trade organization of Islamic terrorism for quite some time. And so I don't think it's going to make any significant difference. I don't think it's going to accelerate it, and I most certainly am convinced it will not decelerate it. The 9/11 suicide bombers did not kill for Osama bin Laden. They killed for Allah and Islam. They were following Muhammad's example and Allah's orders, not Osama's. They screamed the Islamic prayer of fear, Allahu Akbar, Allah is the greatest. Not Osama u Akbar, not Zawahiri Akbar, not even Azamu, the founder of Al-Qaeda, Akbar. No, Allah u Akbar. Allah is greater. Greater than whom? Who wants to be greater? Why would God ever say, I am greater than, which is what this means, I am most great. I am the greatest. Why would God ever want that kind of statement made? Greater than whom? Well, there is a spirit who wants to be greater than the Most High. Hillel ben Shakar, HaSatan, the adversary. Yeshayahu 14 details the strategy that he will deploy. Rooted in Babel, which we call Babylon. Babel is the Hebrew word for mixing, for layering truth and lies together to create a counterfeit, which is what the religions of Islam and Christianity and Judaism have done. No, the 9/11 suicide bombers killed for Allah, Allahu Akbar. It is Allah's great goal to lord over the souls of men, so that ultimately he can be seen as being greater than Yahweh, God himself. As a result, America has lashed out at a symptom and not the disease. So sometime in the next 15 years, this disease will sail nuclear bombs into the nation's cities and detonate them. While Islam will be at fault, Americans will have only themselves to blame. Al-Qaeda defector Jamal Ahmad al-Fadil testified that Osama bin Laden had tried to purchase enriched uranium on the black market for $1.5 million. He was attempting to build a radiological dispersion device known as a dirty bomb and to acquire fissionable material for an atomic weapon. Once this was accomplished in the next 5 to 10 years, fundamentalist Muslim militants like bin Laden, so says the research, will use their own bomb, one they acquire from Russia, or one of Pakistan's nuclear bombs to destroy American cities. Throughout 2000 and 2001, two Pakistani nuclear scientists who worked for Pakistan's Atomic Energy Commission and the ISI, Sultan Bashir ud Din Mahmud and Abdul Majid, made several trips to Kabul, Afghanistan, to meet with Osama bin Laden. Both men shared bin Laden's fundamentalist Islamic beliefs and spent their spare time engaged in the Holy Quran Research Foundation, which even in the United States is listed as a terrorist organization. Mahmoud's son told the Associated Press in December 2002 that the purpose of the visits with bin Laden was to help Al-Qaeda build a nuclear bomb. Both scientists were taken into custody and an ISI safe house after American authorities complained, but they were released by Musharraf shortly thereafter. In Tea with Terrorists, a year after this, fall of 2001. The United States, I wrote that the United States intelligence community learned that an Islamic plot had predicted exactly what I had written, and that what I had written a year prior was accurate. With the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Pakistan, al-Qaeda's plan to create a nuclear hellstorm in the United States was confirmed. Fundamentalist Muslims are preparing to acquire, construct, deliver, and detonate radiological dispersion devices known as dirty bombs in America's largest cities. Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri had not only approved the mission, they had acquired the talents of Dr. X, a Pakistani nuclear scientist, to fulfill their ambitions, just as was predicted in Tea with Terrorists. And as I predicted nearly 10 years ago, and God foretold nearly 2,750 years ago, within the next 20 years, two or more U.S. cities will be laid waste and become uninhabitable. The first entry regarding al-Qaeda can be found on September 3rd, 1967, in the Islamic Terrorism Timeline and on the Prophet of Doom homepage. It details the life of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, and how his company shaped the political fortunes of five American presidents. It also details how al-Qaeda raised money for its terrorist enterprise. Those insights are worth our consideration. Osama bin Laden inherited millions when his Yemenite father, Mohammed bin Laden, the owner of the largest construction company in Saudi Arabia, died in a Beechcraft private aircraft crash, either in Texas or Hemis Masayat in southwest Saudi Arabia, depending on which source you believe. Mohammed bin Laden had married 22 times and had fathered 55 children. Osama bin Laden was the 17th of the religious womanizer. At the time of his father's death, the man who had become the world's most infamous terrorist, Osama bin Laden, was being indoctrinated in fundamentalist Salafi Islamic schools in the mosques controlled by the Saud royal family and schools and mosques that his father had built. Make no mistake, this man was a product of the Saudi educational and religious system. Osama's life history is of interest only because when we know the past of the 19 suicide bombers of 9/11 and the fact that they were all educated and indoctrinated to be fundamentalist Muslims, as was bin Laden, we know that the problem is Islam. And also, when we begin to follow the money trail, we know that the funding for Islamic terrorism is OPEC. In this case, the bin Laden family grossed $5 billion annually, making it one of the largest Islamic corporations in the world. It all began, as I shared with you before, that in 1964, Prince Faisal deposed his half-brother, and in the midst of completing his $1.1 billion extension on his private palace, he awarded the all construction in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the bin Laden family. So he, Mohammed bin Laden, however, made his initial fortune from having exclusive rights, therefore, to all mosques, religious buildings, and educational facilities in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East, you know, anything that the Sauds funded, which are 80% of the mosques throughout the world, all because of OPEC. And in that religious imposition and oppression isn't possible without a show of arms, several of bin Laden's initial construction projects were $1.3 billion for the construction of the security force housing units in Jeddah, $1.3 billion for the National Guard projects in Mecca, and another $1.1 billion for construction of the Kharaj military city near Riyadh. He was also awarded $1.1 billion to build a new royal palace for King Faisal in Mecca, and another $4 billion to refurbish the area around Allah's Kaaba, the center of Islamic power and oppression, and the wellspring of Islamic terrorism. And all this means that Mohammed bin Laden built the facilities that corrupted his son, Osama, into becoming the world's best-known Islamic terrorist. It also means that the West paid the bill by way of OPEC. During his life, Mohammed bin Laden became a sheikh, and as he said before, one of Abdul Aziz's closest allies. He was a Wahhabist, a Salaf, a fundamentalist Muslim. Salim bin Laden, one of Mohammed bin Laden's oldest sons, took over the family religious enterprise upon the patriarch's demise. He was Saudi King Fahd's closest friend, and thus he too was a fundamentalist Wahhab Muslim. And this is where it gets especially interesting. Salim bin Laden's fortune was invested through James Bath, his sole U.S. business representative. In 1977, his most notable investments was in the Abrusco Energy. Abrusco, by the way, is Spanish for Bush. Abrusco Energy, Bush Energy, was a firm founded and run by George W. Bush, the President of the United States during the 9/11 bin Laden attacks. The commission earned on the investment allowed James Bath, who was a member of the Texas Air National Guard along with George, to write a $50,000 check to his pal, making him a partner too. The James Bath bin Laden George Bush connections include President H.W. Bush recruiting Bath into the CIA, according to Time magazine. And there was a commercial air transport connection that evolved through his relationship because Bath purchased the Houston airport on behalf of bin Laden's brother Salim in 1976. That financial transaction was made possible by Khalid bin Mahfouz, the son and founder of the National Commercial Bank of Saudi Arabia. Khalid Mahfouz, who inherited a fortune from his father, became richer still when Salim bin Laden died in a Texas plane crash in 1988. Along the assets he inherited from Salim bin Laden were the Houston airport and bin Laden's interest in George W. Bush's Abrusco oil firm. It was, of course, floundering at that point. Abrusco Energy merged into Harkin Energy, which Khalid Mahfouz remained involved through his BCCI representatives. More on them in a moment. George Bush, who served as Harkin's CEO at the time, denies having any recollection of Khalid Mahfouz's investment or involvement in Abrusco or Harkin. Yet, according to the Modern History Project, Khalid Mahfouz was the largest shareholder of the Harkin Energy Company. What's interesting here is just how impossible it would have been for George W. Bush not to know his partners. In 1982, after George H.W. Bush had made the transition from CIA and UN to vice president, Abrusco became known as Bush Exploration. Knowing that the company was sinking, the new vice president leaned on a family friend, Philip Uzeli, and asked him to invest $1 million in his son's and Salim bin Laden's Bush's exploration in exchange for 10% stake at the time when the whole company. Now, you're talking about investing $1 million in a company whose entire valuation at the time was $400,000, and he got a 10% stake. Now, if you don't think that was done at the request of the current Vice President of the United States and to benefit Salim bin Laden's family and estate, then you're naive. Abrusco Bush nearly collapsed again in 1994 when it was forced to merge with Spectrum 7 Energy. With George W. Bush still at the helm as CEO, the combined enterprise reported a net loss of $1.5 million in 1985 and was ultimately sold to Harkin Oil and Gas in 1986. In 1987, the Saudi investor Abdullah Taha Bashk bought 17% of Harkin. Also buying it at this time was Gayeth Parson, a lead player in the BCCI Bank, which is the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. That was a scandal that we will detail here momentarily. And all of that brings us back to Khalid Mahfouz, BCCI's director, leading shareholder, and George W. Bush's business partner. Before we follow the Khalid Mahfouz and CCI trail to Osama bin Laden and to al-Qaeda, you should know that George Bush's Abrusco Energy and Bush Exploration, Spectrum 7, and Harkin Oil and Gas was saved from financial collapse again in 1990 when the company that couldn't succeed in Texas was mysteriously awarded a contract to drill off the coast of Bahrain. The move shocked industry insiders since Harkin had no previous experience outside the United States nor any drilling experience offshore whatsoever. But George's daddy was a powerful man with OPEC connections, and the Khalid Mahfouz was a player in the world of Islam. Moreover, it was all a sham. In June 1990, George W. Bush sold most of Harkin to a Los Angeles business broker. A week later, Harkin announced an overall loss of $23.2 million, triggering an investigation by the SEC into the sale. This is the prior president of the United States and his father. All the while, George Bush's boss, Khalid Mahfouz, was increasing his net worth to $3.2 billion by money laundering, tax evasion, bribery, illegal investments, arms trafficking, and the sale of nuclear weapons technologies. Also, drug smuggling, illegal immigration, and through the support of Islamic terrorism, according to the BCCI affair report to the Committee on Foreign Relations at the United States Senate. The BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, was founded in Pakistan in 1972. In 1991, BCCI had become the world's worst financial scandal in what was called the $22 billion heist. George W. Bush's financial partner was the director of the largest shareholder and the largest shareholder of BCCI at the time, the Islamic version of Bernie Madoff, owning a 20% stake, and he wasn't alone. John Kerry's Senate report found that former U.S. Defense Secretary Clark Clifford was heavily involved in BCCI, too. Forbes magazine said this of George W. Bush's Abrusco Harkin partner. In 1999, the Saudi government stepped in, buying a controlling stake from Khalid Mahfouz for more than $1 billion. The money was used in part to wipe out some of Khalid Mahfouz's debts from the books. Khalid and his family retained 34% ownership of the new NCBBCCI, but he strengthened his management positions. The extent of Khalid Mahfouz's mismanagement remains shrouded, but the financial conglomerate did acknowledge last year that provisions for bad loans in 1999 alone were nearly $1 billion, end quote. The situation was much worse than that. Khalid Mahfouz's BCCI was found to be worthless, with less than $13 billion in assets accounted for. Investigators told the U.S. and U.K. That BCCI had been organized, quote, to avoid centralized regulatory review and to commit fraud on a massive scale, end quote. This is George Bush's partner. The officials said that BCCI, quote, had its own intelligence network, diplomatic corps, and shipping and commodities trading companies, end quote. BCCI's audits, done by Deloitte Touche and Price Waterhouse, as well as Ernst & Young, their biggest investor, of the Emir Abdul Dubai Bank of America. According to them, their biggest investors were Emir of Abdul Dubai Bank of America and the Bank of England, and they were all mired in this unresolved financial house of terrorist trading cards. But there's more to it than this. Khalid Mahfouz's BCCI was created with capital from Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, an OPEC emir of Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, the nation that transferred most of the funds supporting the 9/11 attack, by the way. That's where they came from. Bank of America, which owned 25%, and the CIA, because the CIA wanted a funding route through Pakistan for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda Mujahideen. While the timing might seem a bit premature, according to the National Security Advisor of the Carter administration, they funded the Afghan Mujahideen by way of the CIA long before the Soviets invaded Afghanistan as a way to lure the Soviets in, creating a Russian Vietnam. And as an interesting aside, in 1988, BCCI was implicated in a drug money laundering scheme based in Tampa, Florida, called the Chase case. BCCI was called the CIA's money laundering facility. In other words, the CIA was complicit in Afghanistan of being the money laundering aspects of the drug production there through this Sea Chase case in Tampa, Florida, by way of BCCI, and use some of the money of drug laundering to fund the Mujahideen. In fact, the BCCI operatives pleaded guilty in 1990 to this very crime, implicating the CIA in the money laundering scheme of drug money. And Khalid Mahfouz's George Bush had picked a fine partner. In March 1991, the Bank of England asked Pricewaterhouse to carry out an inquiry on where BCI's money had gone. Using the codename Sandstorm for BCCI, they submitted a report which said that under their audit, there had been widespread fraud and manipulation, all conducted by George Bush's partner. They detailed how the Abu Nidal terrorist organization was the first one to use airborne suicide bombings, held accounts at BCCI's Sloane Street branch near Harrods in London. Britain's internal security service, the MI5, monitored Abu Nidal's funds transfers and found that the connection between Mahfouz's BCCI and Abu Nidal was an Iraqi named Shamir, and that he had given millions in BCCI financing to fund arms deals with Iraq, always in connection with an American financier named Mark Rich, the financier and campaign contributor convicted of racketeering, who was pardoned by one Bill Clinton on his way out of office in January 20th, 2001. Bill didn't want Mark spilling the beans. In Craig Unger's House of Bush, House of Saud, we found that Mahfouz donated over $270,000 directly to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda at the request of Osama's brother, Salim bin Laden, George Bush's original Abrusco Energy partner. Mahfouz's lawyer acknowledged that the donation was made, but quibbled over the reasons for it. In the U.S. Senate testimony in 1998, CIA Director James Woozy stated that Khalid bin Mahfouz's sister was one of bin Laden's wives, making the two Muslims brothers-in-law, something confirmed by the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times, in addition to Fortune magazine and the Washington Post. Under the onslaught of costly litigation, some of these claims were later retracted. CIA continues to assert that Saudi businessmen have transferred millions of dollars through BCCI to charities operating as fronts for al-Qaeda. For example, Khalid bin Mahfouz set up an Islamic charity called the Mufuk Foundation, meaning Blessed Relief. He personally funded this tax-exempt endowment with $30 million and put his eldest son, Rahman Mahfouz, on the board. But in October 2001, the U.S. Treasury Department named Mahfouz's Mufuk Foundation an al-Qaeda front organization. The director's assets were subsequently frozen by the U.S. Treasury Department. The United Nations has postured numerous allegations that Khalid bin Mahfouz, George Bush's financial partner in Abrusco Oil, was engaged in funding terrorism. These charges came as a result of the report prepared by JCB Consulting for the President of the Security Council of the United Nations in December of 2002. And on it goes. When you follow the money, you will find that American presidents, especially George Herbert Walker Bush and his son, George W. Bush, were funded by the Sauds. Even out of office, George Herbert Walker Bush made his living as part of the Carlyle Group, overseeing the investments of the Saud warlords in Saudi Arabia. The reason that they have chosen to protect them and to keep the truth from you, as it relates to the funding and the creation of al-Qaeda that goes back all the way to the Carter administration, is that the truth would destroy your confidence in the American government. But the truth is what you need to hear. And so this will conclude our review of al-Qaeda and the realization that with the killing of bin Laden, we have made no difference in the onslaught of Islamic terrorism, because he was simply a symptom. One of millions of Muslims educated and Salaf Islamic School, all funded by OPEC. I thank you for listening. We'll return to the introduction to God and tomorrow's program.